Hi, this is Fabi Fab.
And this is Babelito. And we are Latinos Who Lunch, the podcast where we talk about important things like
Kershaw.
Ah, hijo. ¿Qué tal? ¿Cómo están? Audience of Latinx Who Lunch. This is Babelito right here reporting from Chicagoastlán, Illinois. And I am here, I'm dropping off here solo because as you guys may know, Fabi Fab is getting ready for his amazing opening, an exhibition. And actually, this is a good opportunity to talk about this. Fabi Fab is about to have an amazing show together with another important Latinx artist from LA. His name is Ramiro Gomez. You may remember him from episode 19. Ramiro Gomez is an amazing artist who works on highlighting the visibility of Latinx workers throughout, not only Nevada, but throughout the whole entire country. So if you are not familiar with Ramiro Gomez, Google it, loca. So they got together, they started talking, and they decided to have an exhibition. And the Barrick Museum in the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and UNLV is hosting them. The exhibition is opening on April 12th from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. So if you are in Las Vegas, you should totally check it out because I've been getting pictures of the installation. And let me tell you something. I see these pictures y caigo en un abismo de pasión. So if you're in Vegas, definitely check it out. The exhibition is called Sorry for the Mess. And again, it's going to be in the Barrick Museum in Las Vegas, Nevada. The exhibition goes from April 12th to August 3rd. So you have the summer to go and check it out. This incredible exhibition. And again, this is the first time that Justin and Ramiro Gomez are collaborating in this manner. They were together in another exhibition in Denver a while ago. That's actually where they met. But now they're doing something incredible. So they're redefining our ideas about labor. They redefine our ideas about monuments, actually. So it's pretty exciting. But anyway, so one of the reasons why, again, I'm recording solo is because of that, because Fabi Fab is extremely, extremely busy. So he asked me, he's like, please record the intro. Y pues aquí estamos, trabajando, chambeando, ahorita en la noche. So I wanted to introduce this important interview that we're about to listen. So a year ago or so, we were part of a conference, which it was called Money for Your Movements, a social justice fundraising conference. And this was an amazing conference organized by Grassroots Institute of Fundraising Training, or GIFT. And this is an amazing organization. If you don't know who they are, Google it. This is an amazing organization that is dedicated to train people to, in a way, for the redistribution of wealth, because there's so much money laying in the wrong hands out there in the world. And this organization is helping people to bring that wealth back into our communities. And this is exactly what this this interview is about. So when we were part of that conference, we met Edgar Villanueva, who is an expert on social justice philanthropy. And he did a keynote speak of that conference, and it was amazing. It was an incredible, incredible keynote. We were very inspired. We met with him, and he was promoting his book. And the book just came out in October, actually. The name of the book is Decolonizing Wealth, Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance. But I won't tell you a lot more, except that you need to be woke. If you are woke, staying woke is going to hurt. And this is the perfect opportunity to practice, your wokeness. But before we get into the interview, I wanted to tell you a little bit about this artist residency that I work with in Puebla. You guys have heard me talk about Arquetopia several times. They're one of the largest residencies in Latin America, actually. They have a residency in Puebla, a residency in Oaxaca, and also another residency in Peru. And right now, they were able to they were able to gain some money for some incredible scholarships. So right now, they are promoting El Fondo Latinoamericano y del Caribe de Apoyo a Residencias Artísticas de Arquetopia. And this is for residents or for artists that are from Latin American countries, that they were born in Latin American countries, or they were naturalized in a Latin American country and that have lived there for 5 years. So a todos los primos y a todos los primos y los tíos or whatever who you know in Latin America that is an artist, please tell them about Arquetopia. Again, this is el Fondo Latinoamericano y del Caribe de Apoyo a Residencias Artísticas. And all you have to do is go to www.arquetopia.org, and that's spelled ARQUETOPIA.org. Again, arquetopia.org. And in that website, you're going to find everything about the different residency programs they have. If you know, Fabi was one of the residents a couple of years ago. A friend of the podcast, Lance Smith, he's actually there right now. So it really is an incredible opportunity. And if you know some Latin American artists that are interested, just promote the residency and tell them again about this amazing scholarship that they are promoting. Again, arquetopia.org, don't forget it. So sin más que decirles, sin más que reportarles acá desde este pinche frío de Chicago, los dejo con this incredible interview with Fabi Fav and Edgar Villanueva. Turulú, 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 turulú. Ah, cabrón, se me olvidó decirles, Fabi me encargó muchísimo to tell you that the sound is not the best. This is an interview that we did over the phone. As you guys know, we don't necessarily do that, pero de todos modos, the interview is badass. So, si se quejan, pues chinguen a su madre. Bye!
Hello. Hi! Hi, Edgar. It's me, Fabi Fav. How are you? I'm great. How are you doing?
I am doing great. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Of course, it's a pleasure.
Where are you right now?
I am home in Brooklyn, New York. Just got off a red-eye flight a few hours ago, but I've had a nap. I'm ready to go.
Oh, my gosh. You are so busy.
Yeah, I have been really busy, but I'm thrilled that so many people are excited about talking about this work. And so I've, while the oil is hot, as they say, I've been, trying to go at it.
Yeah, and let's get into it. So if you don't know who Edgar Villanueva is, get your life together and do your Google, people. But he is the author of the book, Decolonizing Wealth, Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance. And I am over halfway through your book right now, and I am loving it. So, but before we get into it, I want people to know who you are. Where are you from? Where did you come from? Where are you going? So you're in New York now, but originally you're from North Carolina?
Yeah, I was born and raised in North Carolina. So my people are Native American. I am from the Lumbee tribe, which is a tribe in southeastern North Carolina. We have about 60,000 members in our tribe. And so for generations, my people have been there and have been open to and inclusive of new folks who have come to our community. And so we are a very diverse tribe and community. In fact, Robinson County, where my tribe is sort of centered, is one of the most diverse counties in all of the country because of the tribe, but also just the influx of the immigrant population in North Carolina. And so I have quite a exposure to different cultures and life experiences coming from there. My name is probably something I should explain because I know a lot of your listeners are Spanish speaking and they're like, okay, how do you have the most Latin name on earth? So my name comes from my stepfather, who is actually Filipino, and we know a lot of Filipino folks have Spanish names because of colonization. And so I was adopted by him, and so I have that part of my identity and family that is Filipino as well. And so most of my life I've had to respond to questions like, where are you from and who are you? Why isn't your Spanish fluent? You know, those kinds of things. But I'm kind of a mixed bag of both of experiences.
Yeah, and honestly, when I was reading your book, I was like, wait, she's not Latino? Because I met you last year at the Money for Your Movements conference. You were the keynote speaker. You were so amazing. And I don't know, I was probably Native American and Latinx, you know? That's just what I thought. And mm-hmm. because you do not present like a typical Native American look, which sounds really ignorant of me to say, I know, but you talk about that in the book exclusively too. Like, you come from a place where you're either, you know, like brown or white, right? Black or white, basically. And it didn't, you grew up really didn't diversify until recently, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think the Native American experience is so similar to many Latino, especially indigenous Latino folks from other countries. And I often say, my community in North Carolina, we're not very different from Mexicans, the indigenous Mexicans in down south, because, you know, it's just a matter of who colonized there. We happen to speak English because we were colonized by English-speaking folks. And then, of course, in Mexico and South America, colonized by Spanish-speaking folks for the most part. So I think the history of culture and family and sort of those indigenous kind of values that you find in many Latin communities are something that is really kind of shared across all of those identities. But, yeah, it's kind of it's been a struggle in some ways to have my name is Edgar Garcia Villanueva. Very Spanish. And then when I was growing up, as you said, in North Carolina, I was always in the other box. We had black, white, and then other. And I remember when I was in middle school, I think it's when sort of a huge wave of immigration started happening, and I started seeing immigrants in my school, and I was like so excited because these were people who looked like me and had names like me, and you know, were kind of occupying a similar space within the system because we were, you know, kind of, you know, mixing things up around there.
So
it's been quite a journey.
Yeah. So then I'm gonna fast forward a little bit in your story. You really didn't connect with your Native American roots until, from what I remember, until like you were in your 20s, right?
Yeah, that's right in a lot of ways. When I was very young, my mom left our community, single mother, and we moved to the big city of Raleigh, North Carolina. So, you know, better opportunities and schools and those types of things. And so most of my school age, until I got to college, I was the only Native American in my school. And, you know, I didn't have a major sense of what that really meant because my family, I felt like we kind of lived like most other folks. I grew up in a neighborhood that was historically a black neighborhood and then largely became an immigrant neighborhood, mostly Mexican. And so my, you know, I thought that many of the ways that I lived and showed up in the world was similar to those around me. And it wasn't until I got to college, I went to UNC Chapel Hill, that I joined this American Indian club. And I started kind of noticing, wow, there's a lot of things that I do in my life that actually I think are unique to my Native identity. For me, it was just, you know, just who I was. And it was, I didn't know if it was because I was Southern or because of, you know, maybe Christian. My mom was very Christian, and we went to church on a regular basis growing up. So a lot of these, you know, identities were all just in the mixture for me. But I did later learn, as I got more connected to Native American students and really began doing the work to understand what the culture and values were, what it really meant to be a Lumbee, I found like, oh, a lot of those things are there. I just thought that I didn't know that I did that because I was Native American. I just felt that's what we did, you know.
Mm. Yeah, and just really quick, because you said Native American and American Indian. always say Native American because, I don't know, for some reason I think it's more PC than American Indian. But what are your thoughts on that?
Oh, good question. I'm glad you asked that. I use them interchangeably, obviously, and I think that's totally fine. Neither term is offensive. I think you see Native American more often these days because that's sort of the government box that you see on forms, so it's sort of like Hispanic, right?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, it's either or. Often tell folks if they are not sure Native American is probably a safe way to go. But, yeah, I sometimes just say Indian, but then that can be confusing, you know, if there are people who are from India. So, either is fine.
So there's this thing that happens sometimes when, you know, we fully embrace our identities as people of color, where, you know, for me, I mean, I'm speaking in generalities, but I should just be honest, and I'm talking about me. I'm an artist, and I didn't want to identify as, like, the Latino artist for the longest time because I didn't want to be tokenized and kind of, like, pigeonholed, you know? So, you know, once you become the artist that makes art about being Latino, that's all you're going to be for the rest of your life, you know? Did you ever think about that? Like, if I fully embrace my Native American identity, is this what my life is going to become, you know, kind of thing? And I know it's not a negative thing, but a lot of times, especially in this white supremacist country that we live in, that's not always a good thing, you know?
Yeah, absolutely can relate to that feeling. Yeah, for me, it's even with this book that I have out now, right, where I bring an indigenous perspective to the conversation, there are folks who want me to talk just about Native American things or think that my work is just about Native communities. You know, I've worked with marketing folks and trying to get the word out about the book, and they're like, oh, they're not interested in the Native issues. I'm like, well, the book is not about just Native issues or Native, you know, it's about racial justice and money and power and capitalism and whatever, you know, economic ways of thinking about economic system differently. So it's very easy for people to pigeonhole you or tokenize. And I think, you know, as a Native, because there are so few Native Americans, we also experience sort of like sometimes people sort of romanticize and they're looking for me to give them some like woo-woo, you know, like magical whatever.
They want you to turn to the camera and then like one tear roll down your eye. Absolutely.
You know, and so we talk about this often in Native American circles and different organizations that I work with. It's such a setback often for us to have to always do Indian 101 is what we call it, right, everywhere we go. And so if we're going in for a pitch or a meeting or whatever, we have to account for at least 30 minutes of explaining what Indians are. And yes, we're still here. And no, I don't know your cousin at Oklahoma. You know, those kinds of things. Before we can even get to, like, the word, you know. We're so invisible in this country in a lot of ways. And so that's kind of... So it is sort of like a catch-22. It's like it's a blessing to be an ambassador for your community and to talk about, you know, just how resilient our people are and the amazing, thriving culture and way of life. But at the same time, it's like I am a lot more than just that.
Yeah. I guess it. Oh, my God. I can't even imagine, like, when Pocahontas came out.
Right.
They're like, what do you think? Aren't you
exactly
happy that you're being represented in the media?
Oh, man, I know. It's a trip. It's really, you know, but it is, we are living in a time right now, though, that I feel like there's more visibility of Natives than I've experienced in my lifetime, which is really exciting. We had, you know, Standing Rock, that was one of the he's a major event that kind of put Native communities on the map and politicized a lot of folks around, like, wow, I didn't know these communities were here and they were, you know, working on these types of issues. And so that was really an amazing time in our history for a lot of reasons. It brought a lot of tribes together and created a sense of unity. But in terms of visibility, I think it was really fantastic. Like, if someone doesn't know who Natives are, I'm like, Sandy Rock? And they're like, oh, yeah. So that's been really fantastic. And I have to say, since then, I know in sort of like movement spaces and advocacy work that's happening around the country, there's, you know, folks are a lot more intentional about including Native leaders and Native voices in those spaces. Because I think we're at a point in our lives, in the history of this world, that people are beginning to understand that there is a wisdom and knowledge that exists in indigenous communities that is so valuable and necessary to help us understand how to get out of this mess and to sustain this planet. And maybe to help bring us back together as a community. And so I think that's why one reason this book has been so successful is because people are really hungry right now for a different type of voice that is speaking to, you know, that's surrounded on like hundreds of years of wisdom and knowledge and kind of survival in this country.
Yeah, let's get into the book. So a lot of the work that you started doing from a very young age was with the big philanthropic organization, right? And that's when you started to, I feel like that's when you started to kind of notice these like social injustices when it comes to how money is allocated and how like grants are given out. And I mean, I am part of the art world and I see that all the time, but if you're not part of that, you don't really know how that works. And that's really part of the problem, because mostly people with privilege are the ones that know how that works and how to get that money. You know what I mean? So it's like this, it's just this like system, it's a cycle that goes back and forth. And then it just actually aids in the oppression of the people that they're trying to help, you know? So one of the terms that I absolutely love in your book is the colonizer virus or the colonial virus. I love when you use that. Can you get into that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, so I think, so in the book I sort of use an analogy of the body. There's just a lot of analogies in there. At one point I was like, there's too many analogies, but, you know, it helps us break down these complicated concepts. But, you know, I use the analogy of the body because, you know, the book is about sort of talking about trauma and the trauma that has been caused by colonization and the accumulation of wealth. And then the second part of the book is really a sort of a pathway for healing. So I talk about the colonizing virus because 500 years ago, a virus touched the shores of this country, which was colonization. And the dynamics of colonization, which are all about dividing, separating, conquering, controlling, exploiting, those dynamics are really the dynamics upon which this country was founded. And now, fast forward, you know, 500 years, that colonizing virus has pervaded every aspect and every cell, every interaction, every policy and system in this country, to the point that for us, it's just normal now, like to operate in a world, to be comfortable where there are folks who have and folks who have not. And there are laws and systems that are intentionally built to benefit and to maintain that separation and that division. And for most of us, we're really agnostic about it because we're so infected with this colonizing virus. And so that, what I'm hoping that people understand is really to kind of wake up and remember the history of this country and how those dynamics have sort of infiltrated our way of being and our way of existing, and seeing that virus as it shows up in our public education system, you know, in our food systems, in our foreign policy, like literally everything is there. And so once we are able to identify the virus or see the symptoms of this virus, we can begin a way up, you know, a way to heal from that.
Yeah. So how do you take care of yourself right now? Speaking of healing, we talk about self-care a lot on the Peanutful Lunch, and I know you are traveling all over right now. And so, you know, I have my little routines here and there, but I want to know personally, like, how you think about your mental health while you're on this, journey right now with your book.
No, I really appreciate that question because I have been terrible at self-care.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm from a background similar to a lot of folks where, you know, it's all about work, and got to work harder, two times harder than other people to get ahead or to even be equal. And so I fall into that trap often, feeling like, I haven't done enough or I've got to do more. I've been really fortunate in this process to become a little bit more self-aware and to think about how to manage and take care of myself. Not doing a great job at it all the time, but one, I'm very in touch with my body. I do listen, and my body has a way of communicating to me when it's time to stop. And if I don't stop, it will drop. Maybe it's 20 years ago now. I was in graduate school. And I was working full time and just really had some things going on in my personal life, and I was just super stressed out. And I developed alopecia. I was on a flight on the way to spring break, Puerto Rico. My best friend says, "What happened to your hair? Like, what did the barber do?" And I didn't know what she was talking about, and I look in the mirror, and I just have this round circle in the back of my head. And so long story short, I mean, I realized at that point I'm way too stressed out. My hair is falling out. My body's attacking itself. And so I did the treatment. My hair grew back, and everything was fine. Around the time when this book came out, and things just really went nuts, like the request for speaking, the traveling, I was, burning the candle at both ends. My alopecia came back.
Whoa.
And I was like, oh my God, this is my body is saying stop. And so fortunately I went to treatment again, and I really got focused on ways to balance, the intensity of all of this, because I'm a little bit vain. I don't want my hair looking like that. You know what I mean? Like, it's a very, visible manifestation, of being stressed out. And so I...
Do you have a good shaped head, like, if you shaved it?
Well, you know, fortunately this time, the spot came, and I didn't get, there's two types, I didn't get the total hair loss, I get, like, a spot.
This
time, the spot was under, my hair is kind of long on top, and it was just under a place where I can kind of do the comb over, and you couldn't see it, you know. But, you know, all of that, you know, for me was my body's way of saying, like, you know, got to take care of yourself. So what I do is I get massages. I try to go at least once a week. That's my thing, too. And I live in New York City where things are intense and fast-paced, so I have 1 hour a week where I just, there's no phone, there's nothing where, you know, I'm in a dark room to relieve that stress is something that I really appreciate. Plus, I'm a very sort of physical person. I'm from the South. My family's very touchy. We love on each other. And so I think that the human touch is just really important and therapeutic. So that's my big thing. And then I also try, during this time where things have been super busy, I've tried to be a little more conscious about my eating and not drinking as much and getting more sleep than usual. And knock on wood, I haven't gotten sick, which for me, with traveling two times a week or whatnot, really intense, it's really amazing that my body has sustained itself for the schedule.
Yeah, and I mean, it's It's a lot. It's a lot. And yeah, like you said, you got to kind of stay in tune and listen to what your body's telling you. And that's what I keep telling myself, but you know, we got to work. Right. So let's see. I don't want to talk too much about the book because I know all of our listeners are going to go out and read it. So we don't want to give away too much. But I want to talk about your career just a little bit, because what you were doing earlier in your career and then like maybe what you're doing now and the evolution of that.
Sure. So I went to school for public health and started working in a nonprofit while I was in college that was doing work around HIV and AIDS. And in that work is where I became politicized, really around understanding that certain groups of people in this country did not have the same access to services or grants and even just basic information for their survival. And so that was for about 7 years I worked in that space of sort of public health information campaigns. And then I ended up finding my way into philanthropy. Philanthropy is the part of the nonprofit sector that basically provides grants to nonprofit organizations. Many of these philanthropies or foundations were started by corporations or wealthy families get a major tax write-off, and then you're able to move money to support charitable causes that you care about. And so my first job in philanthropy in North Carolina was at a health foundation. They wanted to hire someone who had experience in the issue area, but they were also looking to diversify their staff in terms of race, ethnicity, and age. I was very young to be a program officer at that time. I was only 28 years old. I had a portfolio of like $25 million, and I traveled all across North Carolina and invested money in various health programs. Some of them like hospitals, building emergency rooms, but then there were other cool ones that were community-based organizations who were doing maybe like health navigator programs and outreach, community outreach and that kind of thing. And so for me, I was, you know, only one of about 10 Native Americans in the country who worked in this field, and maybe there's about 20, 25 now, not a lot. And then it's space where there's just so few people of color, because it's a very wealthy, white, privileged kind of space. These are the people who start these, who have the money to start a foundation, and then they hire within their network. And so it was a really interesting experience, like a great opportunity, but at the same time, I realized pretty early on this space is not created for me to thrive or be successful. And I had to cope with the best of them, like in this role. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
I'm in the community. My people are like, get us some money. Don't let us down. Yeah, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I'm back on the plantation. Literally, my office was on the plantation when I first started. But
Shut up. Literally.
Literally. Yes. Oh, my gosh. And so I'm back in the plantation house, and there I know how I need to behave, dress, act, speak, everything in order to make the case to try to move these resources into the community.
Mm.
And so, you know, fast forward, I'm now working at my third foundation. I left North Carolina, went to Seattle, now I'm in New York. And I've increasingly gotten less interested in like an issue area like health, for example, and more passionate, interested around sort of the art and science of philanthropy itself, like how money is moving through the world. Everything is about money. Whatever issue you care about, when you peel things back far enough, it's about money, right? Our education system and the lack of progressive reforms and support fair is about money. All of this craziness that's happening in our country around immigration and the lack of reform that really works for our communities comes down to money. Of course, racism, but money is really there are people who are benefiting from our prison system and not changing things and keeping things the way they are, and by imprisoning and whatnot. So I think it's really important that we all understand and learn about money and how money flows, who decides about money, who gets to manage it, how it's invested. And so that has been my career, is really finding out where is the money and how can I tap into that money and get that money for our community. And so that I am a professional philanthropist, grant maker, funder, and now with some years under my belt, 15 years, and a lot, which is a long time for a person of color to survive in this space. I'm kind of like one of the OGs now. I've kind of earned earned some respect, and I was able to write this book, and I'm able to speak at conferences and kind of speak truth to power in a way that I was not able to a long time ago.
We're
in a different place. The field is really embracing ideas of diversity, equity, inclusion. So I hope that for future generations, things will be better working in this space. But so that's what I do. I'm kind of a disruptor, level rouser, or whatnot. But I'm amazed at how many people want to have kind of real talk conversations about money and power and race. And that's how I'm spending most of my time these days.
Wow. Yeah. Something powerful that I took from your book was this idea that money is like the root of all evil, but really it's how you use that money, right? And I think just like being informed, and it goes a long way, right? And that's like a big agent of racism and white supremacy is not educating the people that would benefit from it. So I'm really grateful for your book, because there was a lot of Oprah aha moments when I was reading it. So I think it's really helpful. And yeah, you don't have to be from like a nonprofit or philanthropic background to really enjoy the book and get a lot out of it. So that was really cool, because I was afraid it was going to be too like inside baseball. I don't, it's a sports reference. I don't know what that means, but it's like too specific, I guess. definitely, I really love that you kind of just like broke it down and came from a very personal place. And I always find that to be like, to me, just like more entertaining and more, the more personal, the better, because I related to it. When it's more personal, it's also more political, and that's always important, I think.
No, that was my aim. I think that all of us, especially people of color, indigenous, Latino, our Black brothers and sisters, everybody, we have such a rich cultures and very rich values and ideas around what it means to be in community, how to take care of one another, how to love one another. Some of that is just sort of really deeply a part of our culture. And so I'm just trying to spread love with this work. I think philanthropy means the love of mankind, or the love of humankind. And working in that space in particular, where we're moving money to help people, where is the love? And so I'm saying that we, the resilient folks, the people of color in this country who have survived so much and are still going through so much, actually have a lot of wisdom to share about how this country should be, like what the best version of ourselves as a nation could look like and be based off the values that we all celebrate within our different cultures.
Yeah. That just reminded me about a part in your book where a lot of these companies, we talk about diversity a lot on Latino Food Lunch, and how we call it the B word, and how it's always spun as a positive thing, but it's not. Diversity is a trap sometimes, just like disability. And just because somebody works in your company that looks like a person of color doesn't mean that that you're actually allowing them to occupy the space and actually share their experience with the rest of the company. A lot of times you work for a company and you're just supposed to like fall in line to the culture that already exists instead of learning from everybody's culture, which is, that's really the benefit of diversity, you know?
Right. That is a multi-million-dollar statement. I get calls probably every week from search firms looking to place leaders in different nonprofits and foundations, and they're looking for people of color, which I appreciate, right? For diversity, representation does matter. Mm-hmm. So you're right, it's so much more than that. You know, I talk about that a lot in the book because I felt like going into these organizations as the only, you know, there's this process of like forced assimilation. And it's like, oh, I thought you wanted me because I was like Native and cute. You know what I mean? Like, not because of like, you know, but they're like, oh no, we want you to be here, but we don't want all of you. We want you to do the work in these deep ways. They don't be prescribing how I dressed and how what car I needed to be driving, because mm-hmm. that was a reflection of the organization. So that's the work that is to be done when, you know, we group DEI together a lot nowadays, diversity, equity, inclusion. Diversity is like the easy thing. It's easy to find people of color, but we have to push our folks into, you know, understanding what white dominant culture is, how that scares up in these organizations, because I always am reluctant to give names of people of color to some of these organizations unless I understand that they have done their work to make sure their business or nonprofit is a place where people of color can thrive and bring their whole self to work and all that they have to offer. Then otherwise, you know, we're really oppressing folks by bringing in people of color into these spaces and forcing them to, you know, not be who they are, or not bring their ideas and best thinking to the work.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I know you're a busy man, and I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but since we are Latinos Who Lunch, we always like to talk about lunch a little bit. Did you have lunch already over there in New York?
I have been having a little bit of lunch while we're talking. And just
okay.
So today I have like one of my faves when I've been out of town and I get back home. I just want it all the time. It's basically some shredded chicken slaw with a sandwich. There's a grilled chicken sandwich on this French bread. I think it's a place that sells all things Asian. So it's a Vietnamese sandwich. So like,
ooh.
And then I dip the sandwich in the soup. It's so good.
Yeah. Oh my God. Okay. Did you grow up in the Filipino stepfathers?
No, I did not.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask you. Did you grow up with Filipino food?
No, I didn't get it until later in life. I got reconnected with my Filipino family. Kind of later, but they have compensated for the loss of food by overfeeding me later in life with delicious food. Yeah. All of that.
Oh my gosh. Well, Edgar, thank you so much again for taking the time to talk to me. And again, the book is called Decolonizing Wealth. You can find it online wherever books are sold. And are you, what's going on this year for you? Anything exciting that we should know about?
Yeah, so if you check out our website, decolonizingwealth.com, we're still on tour. Next week I'll be in Chicago for a huge event at the Chicago Museum and at the Goodman Theater. So we are just kind of out having conversations and having fun. You know, bringing laughter and a little bit of glamour to this work. We don't have, you know, just to make it fun and exciting. So we're on tour. You can check out events there. We also launched a T-shirt. All of the proceeds from the sale of the book and the sale of the T-shirts, they're decolonizer T-shirts. They're really cute. We're selling those to raise money to support Native youth organizing. And so that's kind of the focus. It's like, keep stirring up the conversation, this tour, and then also selling products and raising money to support Native youth. And I like to have Native youth with me at these events. So if you come out, you'll have a chance to meet some dynamic and people who are doing great things in their communities.
Awesome. That's great. All right. Well, get some rest, get a massage, take care of yourself.
Yes.
And, yes, and keep decolonizing. And whenever I first heard that term, it cracked me up. And now it's like everybody's decolonizing everything, right? Their diet, their education, and it's so important. It's so important that we think about it in that way. And this book and your message is really making an impact. So thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate being on and talking with you.
Awesome.
Turulu, 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 turulu. ¿Cómo les quedó el ojo, cabrones? That was an amazing, amazing interview. And I especially like the part about self-care, because when we are so involved talking about these ideas and these systems, the way that the colonial virus, as I talked about in the interview, still affects us today, it's something that we need to be very mindful of. So when we engage in conversations with other people about these ideas, when we are teaching others about some of these traumas, we have to also remember to take care of ourselves. So I'm so thankful that Favi asked this question, because the work that Edgar Villanueva is doing, it's amazing, but it's also very, very, very tiring. So with that in mind, I always go to music. I always go to music and cooking, actually. And right now, I've been cooking a storm, all kinds of different things. But I always go to music, and I want to recommend an album that, and since, you know, I am not part of this interview, but, and I'm very jealous, but I'm also very happy that Favi still made it happen. But I wanted to add to that idea of self-care. And the album that I'm about to recommend is from an artist that we talked about in Latinos Who Lunch for years now. After Trump's election, we all were in a very strange position. And I remember that the music of El Lado Negro helped me heal from that process. And it did for a lot of people. Young, Latin, and Proud became an anthem for a lot of us. And it was a reminder that, you know, that we need to continue fighting, that we cannot allow these processes take over completely over us. So again, my healing instrument has always been music. And El Lado Negro has done it yet again. He has come out with what I think is going to be one of the best albums of this year already. This is the album is called This Is How You Smile. It is his best work to date, in my opinion, from the opening song, Please One Please, all the way to the end of My Name Is For My Friends. Every single song is about that. It's about healing, especially, for example, me being in Chicago, adjusting to the weather. I appreciate the song, for example, País Nublado. If you haven't listened to El Lado Negro, like, put your shit together, man. Put your shit together and start listening to him, but especially this album. This album, for me, just like Los Walters was at the end of last year, has been an incredibly, incredibly, incredibly important album for just to centralize myself, to centralize my energy, and to continue the fight. Because believe it or not, going into the classroom, it always seems like a fight. Again, thank you so much, Favi. Thank you so much, Edgar Villanueva, for this amazing, amazing, amazing interview. I hope everybody's taking care of you. I hope you guys are taking care of yourself. I always say you guys, but you know, the patriarchy, I can help it. I hope everybody's taking care of themselves. And let us know. Send us an email and let us know what kind of things you do to heal. What kind of things you do to protect yourself from some of this oppressive system, because the oppressive system not only affects us today, but just even engaging in conversations can be a very, very, very oppressive task. Again, the album is This Is How You Smile, and don't forget to take care of yourself, and I will leave you with that. And I hope you guys have a wonderful week, and nos vemos la semana que entra. And thank you, everybody, for your patience. Please keep sending your letters. Keep sending your letters to us, LWLpod, and we can respond to letters. Hopefully, Favi and I are going to get together, and we're going to talk a little bit more about a lot of this, a lot of these ideas and a lot of, and hopefully you can send us your letters about taking care of yourself. So again, send us your letters, rate us on iTunes, five stars only. That is very important. It gives us visibility, and visibility leads to representation, and representation, as we always say, matters. So again, thank you everybody, and have a wonderful week. Ciao, ciao, ciao.